I was part of the women's liberation movement in New York City and the daycare movement. And the daycare movement is an aspect of women's liberation that's been largely ignored because the media and even some academics refuse to acknowledge that some feminists were pro-child, pro-motherhood, and pro-family. And younger academics and women of color who criticize the women's liberation movement for being largely white and middle class often overlook the class and racially integrated daycare movement. Policymakers, sociologists, and psychologists write about daycare, but rarely historians. And users of daycare seldom tell their story. Vicki Breitbart, who was a mother and a daycare and women's liberation activist and a nursery school teacher in the early 70s, pointed out that, quote, the daycare component of the women's liberation movement was never part of the women's liberation movement mainframe, but it was a significant part. Most of the participants were mothers of infants or young children, nursery school teachers, and some socialists and radical feminists who were active in the women's movements. Daycare centers were established in every state and major city. In New York City, we accomplished more because New York had a special history, which I don't have time to elaborate, except to say that New York City had the first daycare in the United States in 1854 and was the only city outside California to keep its daycare centers after World War II due to this grassroots struggle and a very receptive mayor. By the 60s and through the 70s, daycare became a national issue due to really a constellation of forces: government bureaucrats concerned about welfare reform, educators concerned with early childhood development, a strong civil rights movement calling attention to the needs of African Americans, a poor people's campaign, and women concerned with the need to work and pressing for liberation. Working mothers were no longer objects of pity or part of an emergency like the Depression or war, but a force that society had to address. By 1970, over 40% of women worked. The percentage of working mothers with children under six who were in the labor force had increased from 19 to 30% during the 30s. 3.5 million, or over 17% of all the children in the U.S., lived in families under the Office of Economic Opportunities poverty line, which was $3,885 for a family of four. The Women's Bureau in 1965 did a study of child care arrangements for mothers who worked at least 27 weeks or more and found that half of preschool children were cared for in their homes, about a third in someone else's home, and only 5% in any group facilities, and the rest in makeshift arrangements. The first conference on daycare in peacetime was held in Washington in 1960 and was called by the Women's Bureau and the Children's Bureau, and their recommendations followed the same segregated system of services in the past: public daycare for poor, private nurseries for the affluent, and potluck services for those in between. Now, some national organization of women members were involved in lobbying for this Brademas-Mondale daycare bill, which was a comprehensive plan that called for child care for underprivileged children, but that was vetoed by President Nixon. Now members set up a few daycare centers, but the centers were short-lived, professional, hierarchical, mainly white, middle-class, paying children, although there was a sliding scale. There were none in New York City. It's interesting that NOW, which concentrated on employment, didn't give rise to a grassroots daycare movement. Many of their members, at least in New York City, were older or single and didn't have young children and didn't live in low-income neighborhoods. The women's liberation movement came from the New Left and the civil rights movement with a decentralized self-help ideology. The Students for a Democratic Society had set up neighborhood service centers and in Newark an alternative school. So daycare centers were an extension of these New Left initiatives, equivalent to the self-help health movement. In contrast to now, the Women's Liberation Movement set up daycare centers in every state and in New York City, at least 50 that I know of. Women's liberation activities in daycare are hard to find out about because the movement was decentralized and very few daycare activists wrote about the activities. The women's liberation movement was important as we had a utopian community-oriented philosophy as well as a rich practice. Platforms on most women's liberation groups demanded daycare. For example, at the Congress to Unite Women held in New York City in 1969, a national coalition of women's liberation groups called for 24-hour childcare centers, employment equality for women, and the deduction of childcare expenses from taxable income. In New York, there was one issue, at least that's the only thing I found, of the voice of mother in children's liberation. It was a little mimeographed newsletter. For some women in the feminist movement, childcare became a political issue and a means to achieve social and economic equality in a class society. Feminist daycare not only allowed the large numbers of working women free space, but also freed women from the family and brought the family and children into the wider world. Looking to broaden women and children's horizons, feminist mothers began setting up community-controlled daycare centers in their neighborhood. Being anti-state, the New Left and the Women's Liberation Movement first took a voluntary approach. Feminists resented the regimentation, placement by IQ and class, and the sexism in the publicly funded schools and chose another route. In New York City, mainly mothers, with some help from dads and teachers, set up their own unlicensed underground childcare centers for children 6 months to four. In setting up illegal centers, we challenged existing regulations, for example, china dishes and certain amount of space per child and teacher ratios. Some rules were rigid and others, like fireproofing, in retrospect made sense. There were fires at a few centers and many centers had mice and cockroaches. Beginning in 1967 and continuing into the early 70s, feminists and community activists rented vacant storefronts, usually for under $100 a month, fixed them up, and parents in the community were invited to participate. The fees were small. At Liberation Nursery on the Lower East Side, begun by feminists and local community parents, participants paid $20 a month if you worked full-time, $12 if you worked part-time, $5 if you worked less, and if you didn't have it, that was fine. Some wealthier parents lent the co-op money when it was necessary. Parents were expected to put in time taking care of the children at least once a week and help fix up the place on weekends, which involved plumbing, plastering, cleaning up the backyard, and painting. The storefronts were in old, rundown buildings, and that's why they were inexpensive. Liberation Nursery was a co-op with no one in charge, bi-monthly meetings, and no responsible teacher. We also had regular volunteers from a men's liberation group. Red Paint on the Upper West Side rented an inexpensive basement and a women's movement and newsreel, which was an SDS film collective, fixed it up and hired a teacher, although it was run collectively and charged fees. They also got some money from a small foundation. Red Paint, Children's Mansion, Liberation Nursery, Children's Underground, and dozens of others are still in existence today. Other daycare centers, really more short-run ones, were in seized buildings. Like at Columbia University, activists and mothers seized a building for daycare, and that center does still exist. In one case, Bella Abzug, who was running for the House of Representatives, gave the Village Co-op Nursery part of her campaign headquarters, which wasn't without problems, as she constantly interrupted the daycare to pose for reporters with the kids. However, it gave the Village Co-op a chance to get started while looking for another place. Some centers were in buildings that were taken over, like old welfare centers, and they didn't last that long because it was too difficult to maintain them. By 1969, many of the underground unlicensed centers, mostly those in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, began to realize that running a center on a shoestring budget was arduous and in the future near impossible. Dozens of these poorer centers called a meeting to try to fight for government funding. As a result of our first meeting, the Committee for Community Daycare was formed to fight for quality daycare funded by the city. The organizer of the committee was Robert Ganji, a caseworker who had recently been laid off by Jules Sugarman, who was the commissioner for the Human Resources Administration, and he was soon to move to Washington and be very key in setting up Head Start. Ganji had been involved in setting up daycare in the Endicott Hotel, a place where welfare recipients were housed, that also failed to meet the city requirements. The co-chair of our committee was Dorothy Pittman Hughes, a feminist Harlem activist who owned three uptown daycares and with Gloria Steinem founded Ms. Magazine in 1972. Ganji eventually received some foundation funding for the committee, which paid his and Pittman Hughes a small stipend. 90% of the committee members were female, but like welfare rights, a man was the chair. Ganji was a principled radical, but most of the women felt that a male chair with lots of government experience would give us prestige. Most of the subsequent meetings involved discussions of the city's red tape and how to get funded in spite of it. One or two centers, like West 80th Street, with community support, had already held large, loud demonstrations of over 100 people at the Department of Social Services and received money without meeting the city's requirements. In the spring of 1970, the members of the committee demanded immediate funding for the operating child care programs. The money would be used for repairs, equipment, to pay decent wages and health care benefits to those working in the centers, and to provide on-site training to the parents. In order to publicize these demands, parents and community activists from seven centers blocked traffic in the streets in front of Children's Storefront. At the same time, other members of the committee and supporters sat in at the Mayor's Task Force on Daycare. A group, which included me and some other activists, had been appointed by our Republican liberal, Mayor Lindsay, to advise the city on infant daycare. Lindsay had a strong civil rights record, and for the first time, people of color in New York City had determined the mayoral race. At the sit-in, we demanded that the task force act as an advocate for community daycare. Every community daycare center had waiting lists, and the mayor's task force knew and shared with the committee that the city had allocated $5 million in 1969 that couldn't be spent as the daycare centers didn't meet requirements. Many landlords instead had been given the money to renovate barber shops, restaurants, and in one case, a skating rink. By the fall of 1970, what I can say is that we managed to get the city to pay for all the daycare centers. And the city and state agreed. Then President Nixon came in, and New York State decided that they wouldn't fund our daycare centers. And Lindsay, who was still mayor and running for president on the Democratic Party, took over all the funding. However, after he became mayor, the daycare centers only accepted people on welfare and poor people. They had been about 30% middle class people. It was mixed. But with the state pulling out the funds and then the city saying they would only fund welfare families, they went back to being mainly welfare with about 10% of people who paid. But all the centers, all these underground centers, got funded. And many of them had feminist programs in that they were non-hierarchical. They had girls doing things that boys usually do, boys playing with dolls. They also had a lot of stress, not only on the individual, but the group. We favored wagons instead of bicycles that you could ride individually. Non-competitive. We celebrated International Women's Day, Bastille Day, and other holidays. And when I went back to visit the centers now, which are far bigger in much better buildings than we were in, I only visited 12 of them. They survived, and they're mainly children of color, lots of immigrants, because there's lots of new immigrants in New York City now. And they had our feminist books from Feminist Press books. They were still there. The teachers had some kind of feminist consciousness. They weren't celebrating International Women's Day. Parents weren't involved the way they used to be. They were working, and they really weren't involved in the center. There were some men working at the center, but it was mainly women at the centers. And mothers and no fathers almost were involved. And it was, I think, a successful battle. I mean, we certainly didn't win on our terms, but a whole lot of daycare got funded, and a lot of people engaged in this struggle together. And for a while, we did have integrated by class and race daycare centers. Okay.